The time is 10 o'clock. Good morning. I'm Dan Olson in St. Paul. Our guest this morning is Joe Graba, former state legislator, now working in the Minnesota Department of Education as a deputy commissioner, and a former biology teacher from Wadena in central Minnesota. All of those elements of Mr. Graba's background are important for our conversation today, which is about the financial problems being faced by many school districts around the state. The Minnesota Constitution says that the legislature shall provide a general and uniform system of public schools. Public education in this country is the responsibility of state government for most of its part. All of the states except Hawaii have delegated the operation of schools to local school districts where the school administration and the elected school board run the show. The local residents pay for schools' operation through the local property tax, which is supplemented by some state and federal money. Public education has changed rather dramatically in the past few years. Many more people are being educated, and a lot more money is being spent. In terms of people, public elementary and secondary education is one of the largest enterprises in Minnesota, involving about 25% of the state's population and about 6% of the state's workforce. Those percentages break down into the following numbers. Over 53,000 professionals serving about 863,000 students. And in terms of money, the state pays for almost two-thirds of the elementary and secondary education costs, a total of about $900 million a year. The job of planning how to educate our state's younger residents was summed up pretty well in one word some years ago. That word was growth. Many suburban, urban, and some rural districts had increasing numbers of students that required more buildings and teachers. But the situation has changed rather dramatically in some districts. Student enrollment has declined in some areas. The costs of educating students has increased, and state law has changed some of the ground rules, too. The problems that districts face are diverse. Declining enrollments, as we mentioned, has forced some districts, especially some Twin Cities suburban districts, to cut district budgets by hundreds of thousands of dollars, which means fewer staff people and, in many cases, cutbacks in educational activities. The problem facing some rural districts is a bit different. Farmland prices are increasing rapidly, so rapidly that the local tax is generating more money than supplied by state aids to schools, which means the districts are not eligible for the state aids. We'll have a bit more on that later. We've invited Joe Graba to discuss some of these matters and perhaps help us understand what all this means to state citizens and students, and we'll be taking questions from listeners in a few minutes. First of all, Joe, I was hoping you could give us a summary of some of the factors that have led to the current situation, especially for many suburban Twin Cities school districts, where it is necessary for administrators and citizens to cut the district budget. What's led up to that?
Well, Dan, I think the major factor that is causing the financial squeeze in school districts is, in fact, the declining enrollment. And it really doesn't necessitate a declining enrollment in order to create the situation. Simply a level enrollment would cause the same sort of problems, only to a lesser degree. As school districts were growing in the past 15 years, they consistently were hiring new teachers. And new teachers come in at the bottom of the salary schedule generally, and they come in with the minimal education requirements. A stabilized enrollment means that fewer new teachers are hired, and consequently, they gain experience through years, and salary schedules, of course, pay teachers higher incomes for increased experience. In addition to that, teachers, after they've been on a job a year or two, generally go back and get advanced degrees, which also increases their income, and that has led to the problem. The declining enrollment aspect is just a little bit severer situation than that, in that with declining enrollment, teachers are being laid off, and they're laid off at the bottom of the salary schedule. The cheapest teachers, therefore, are laid off, and the school districts end up with consistently older staffs, better educated staffs, and therefore more expensive staffs. In addition to that, some more factors that I'd like to mention is a couple of recently established priorities in education. For years, this state and many states in the nation have ignored the basic rights of handicapped children. And within the last 6 or 7 years, our state has made a massive effort to bring quality education to the handicapped children. That's generally referred to as special education, and special education costs have simply skyrocketed. in this state in the last 7 years. Another area is the secondary vocational aspect. I don't believe that most educators would argue with the fact that our educational system is still aimed disproportionately at the college-bound student. And the state and local districts have been attempting to get more vocational education into the systems in order to provide some basic exploratory vocational courses for the young people. Both of those two priorities have added substantially to the cost. We've had additional aspects, for instance, court cases revolving around the rights of girls to athletic opportunities. And, of course, that has additionally added to the expenditures of local school districts.
Now, you mentioned the fact that teachers' salaries are increasing almost every year, and that, I think, is the question in the front of many people's minds. How much do increasing teachers' salaries contribute to rising school costs?
Well, obviously the increasing salaries does add to the school cost. We have done, however, some recent research. It's fairly preliminary at this point, but the indications are that Minnesota is following a national trend in education, and that national trend indicates that a smaller percentage of the instructional expenditure is going for salaries today than was the case 5 or 10 years ago. Now, that's sort of contrary to what most people believe. It's contrary to what most people in state government thought was the case. But there is a national trend that indicates that salaries in education are taking a smaller percentage of the total expenditure than they did several years ago, which I think indicates simply that a whole host of fixed costs are escalating at a more rapid rate than salaries.
Fixed costs, you mean like energy, for example, is more expensive, textbooks?
That's right. Supply expenditures, maintenance expenditures, the energy situation obviously has created that.
Now, we mentioned that a number of districts, especially suburban districts in the Twin Cities, are having to cut their budgets because of the tough financial situation. What does that mean? Does that mean that the quality of the education in those districts is declining, that there are many fewer educational opportunities for the students?
Yes, I think there isn't any question, but what many of the, especially the inner ring suburbs, have been forced to cut back on programs. That generally means that there are fewer choices left to those children who are coming up through the system. That is, I think, a reality of declining enrollments. Because of the declining number of children in the schools, it simply gets inefficient to offer some courses because they are offered at less than maximum capacity. And that, of course, forces the school districts to trim those programs.
What are some of the things that are being trimmed, other than a number of extracurricular activities?
Well, what is being trimmed varies tremendously all over the state. There, I believe, has been some trimming of junior high athletic programs, and there has been a substantial trimming in specialty courses, language courses, for instance, and some specialty music courses and so on, drama perhaps. But it's very difficult to get an accurate understanding and to summarize it, because what is trimmed varies from one school district to another depending on the desires of the local people.
Now, I want to turn for a minute to some of the legislative proposals that have been put into the mill at the Capitol in St. Paul, or proposals that may be made in the coming days. In fact, Governor Perpich, in his budget message to the legislature a few days ago, proposed an increase in the per-pupil expenditure from about $960, what it is right now, to about $1,025. Will that help ease the budget situation in any way?
Oh, yes, I think it will, but I've been saying for several months now that there is no total solution to this problem other than cutbacks. I have seen some pretty accurate projections that indicate that the legislature would have to fund the foundation aid a program at double the cost of living in order to prevent some program cutbacks in some of the inner ring suburbs. Now, I know, and I believe anybody that studied the school finance system knows, that the legislature is not going to fund that formula at double the cost of living. And consequently, while any increase will decrease the amount of pain that's experienced in school districts, I've been telling people that it's not going to eliminate the pain.
One of the questions that is in the front of some people's minds, perhaps not everyone, is, well, first of all, maybe we better back up for a minute. You mentioned foundation aid formula, and this might be a good time for some definitions. What is this foundation aid formula you talk about, and how does this formula determine what is spent on education in the various districts?
Okay, the foundation aid formula is the formula that the state uses to distribute the bulk of its aid to school districts. And the foundation aid formula interacts with local property wealth. But that the combination of the foundation aid and the local levy, the 29 mills as it exists now, is the fund that finances the general operation of the school district. The salaries, the supply, the maintenance expenditures, except for major maintenance of buildings and so on.
Okay, now I want to return in a few minutes to some other details regarding that formula, but the second question I had regarding your statement that legislators are reluctant to increase the expenditure for the foundation aid formula also seems to be reflective of a general unwillingness among many people to simply spend more money on education. Do you think that's an accurate reflection? And if so, why are people unwilling to spend more money for education, do you think?
Well, I don't want to imply that the legislature is unwilling to increase the foundation aid formula. I don't believe that there's any question in the minds of the legislators that it has to be increased at least as much as the cost of living. In fact, the recommendations that Governor Perpich has made to the legislature would be for increases in the per pupil unit amount somewhat above the projected increases in the cost of living. And so I think I believe it's fair to say that the legislature understands to at least some degree the financial squeeze on school districts. But there are a lot of people who are aware of the fact that we have fewer kids in our schools today than we had 5 years ago. And of course, it gets difficult to consistently put more money into the educational program when in fact we have fewer children.
Well, where does the amount of money we spend on educating our state's young people, for example, compare? How does it compare with the amount of money we spend on other activities, for example, highways?
Well, the highways, highway construction, of course, is funded exclusively out of the gasoline tax, and that's a dedicated tax under our Constitution. But there isn't any question but what there's been increased priority selection required at the state government level because a whole host of issues have developed in the recent years that demands state revenue. Legislators who served in the state legislature in the 60s did not deal with reserve mining issues, did not deal with pollution control, environmental problems, did not have housing projects at the state level, and so on. And so there are increased demands and increased competition in the legislative process for state revenue.
Now, as I understand, there is a referendum provision in state law that permits a local school board to hold a special election to try increase the local mill rate levy of the district. Are many Twin Cities area districts using this device to try to solve their budget problems?
Well, there are a variety of Twin City districts that have run the referenda, but not a very high percentage of them have passed it. I believe at the last tally there were 100 referenda that had been run in the state, and 61 of them had passed. But the proportion of those that have been in the Twin City area is relatively small. Generally speaking, the school districts where the referendum is the survival issue, generally in the western and southern and northwestern areas that have high valuation ag land with extremely severe declining enrollments, have passed them. But they're generally very small districts.
And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we may be able to talk about some fairly interesting case studies that some rural school districts face in terms of paying for their educational costs.
Right.
Before we get to that, though, I want to return to this discussion about your opinion as to what you think people feel about the educational process. I know many are concerned about how the tax dollars are being used for education. Maybe this is one of the reasons more people are encouraging educators to return to teaching the basics, as they call it. Is it also a factor, do you think, in what has been called minimal competency testing? And maybe you should describe what that's about.
Well, there is. Let me first of all say that fewer young people in the schools, I think, means that we have fewer people in the population who are vitally interested in the educational program. We have fewer parents, for instance, today than we had 5 years ago, and consequently fewer voters who are vitally interested in the quality of the education program. Secondly, I believe that we have a declining faith in the population in education. Now, Minnesotans generally still have more faith in education than do most populations in the United States. But I believe that faith is declining. And I'd like to sum it up and simply say that fewer people today view education as the pathway to the good life than was the case 5 years ago. And the combination of the fewer parents and that declining faith is making it more difficult to finance some of the programs in our schools.
But despite the fact that they may not view it as the path to the good life any longer, I sense a growing concern that if they're going to send their children to school, they definitely want their children to come out of the school being able to read, write, knowing the basic skills. And is this the feeling that is one of the moving forces behind the call for standardized testing or minimal competency testing?
Yes, I think that's a fairly accurate assessment, Dan. I guess I'm inclined to think that we had no good reason to expect that we could add all of the things into the schools that we have added in the last 15 years without somehow diluting some of our efforts towards the basics. For years, the schools have sort of been the catch-all for studying and hopefully solving a whole host of social ills. Drug education and driver's education and social activities that normally were not part of the responsibility of the educational community. Those things have been dumped into the schools. I don't believe it's reasonable that we should expect that would not lead to some dilution of what we now refer to as the basics. There is concern about the children not learning to read as well. There is concern about them not being able to write and do the basic sorts of things that we normally think schools ought to do. And we have had legislation introduced into this legislative session that would mandate that children achieve certain levels before they pass on to the next grade. That sort of topic, I think, is going to get a lot of discussion in this legislative session. Recently, the department has come up with a set of minimum standards that would be requirements on school districts. And they have not been, they're not rules and regulations yet, but they're under discussion. And it's difficult at this time because any set of minimum standards has financial implications for school districts. And consequently, to impose those at the same time that the school districts are already having severe financial problems may be an impossibility.
What kinds of financial implications are you talking about, Joe?
Well, one of the requirements, for instance, is the requirement that every child have available to them a certain number of course offerings in a secondary school system. Many of the smaller school districts in the state simply do not have those offerings. In addition, these minimum standards, and if they're going to mean anything, have to be minimum opportunities for children. And while any school system might offer those opportunities to be able to guarantee any one individual child that they can get into those opportunities regardless of scheduling problems, has severe financial implications for the school districts.
And quite apart from that, do you think that the minimum competency testing or the standardized test results will tell us anything about whether or not the child is receiving the basic skills?
Well, yes, I think that, you know, it depends on the instrument that's used, obviously. If the right instruments are used, obviously we can, you know, judge whether or not the child is moving in the right direction. That's true with respect to at least a few basic skills that we're interested in. Reading is very measurable. Mathematics is very measurable. However, if one wants to try to analyze the commitment that the educational system is developing in young people concerning the environment, that's totally different. And it's very difficult, for instance, to measure how well the schools are teaching our young people to be concerned about energy conservation. And so when you get into that domain, it's pretty difficult to accurately measure.
We're talking with Joe Graba, a Deputy Commissioner of Education from the Minnesota Department of Education, a former school teacher, a biology teacher, and a former state legislator. The time now, about 21 minutes after 10 o'clock. We'll open our phone lines now for callers who want to pose questions to Mr. Graba. In the Twin Cities listening area, 291-1222. That's 291-1222. For listeners outside the Twin Cities who are listening to Mr. Graba, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-652-9700. That number again is 1-800-652-9700. And we will wait just a moment for some calls to come in. There is one question that I wanted to return to for a moment, Joe, that is sort of a thought question, and it may be a bit longer than we're able to handle in even the 40 minutes remaining. But is it your opinion that despite the financial crisis that many Twin Cities suburban districts face, for example, that the quality of education is generally good?
Oh, yes. I don't believe that there's any question but what Minnesota still provides, you know, some of the highest quality education in the United States. In my job as a legislator and now as deputy commissioner, I have the opportunity to visit with a lot of people from other states concerned with this very issue. And many states throughout this country would gladly trade positions with the state of Minnesota. To just give you a quick example, South Dakota, for instance, relies heavily on property taxes to run its school system. And in Minnesota, we have only the real estate tax, not the personal property tax anymore. So I recently visited with the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee from South Dakota, and because of the drought, many of the farmers in South Dakota have been forced to sell off large percentages of their cattle. Those cattle, under the personal property tax system, are part of the tax base. And consequently, those school districts are not going to have near the tax base that the legislature thought they would when they carved out the school aid formula 2 years ago. That legislature now has to go in and react to that lost tax base. In some school districts, the personal property tax base has been reduced by 70%. So they have severe financial problems. We haven't closed any schools in Minnesota as a result of our finance system. Ohio has, Oregon has, Washington, the state of Washington is having more severe problems than we are.
Now, we haven't touched on a lot of issues. We have not, for example, talked about the situation that the St. Paul and the Minneapolis school districts face. We have not talked about the proposal to consolidate some school districts administratively, but we'll be getting to those. However, our first caller is on the line right now. Go ahead, Mr. Graba is listening to your question.
Thank you very much. My question to your guests is that I was wondering whether the assertion that there are too many suburbs in the area is one of the reasons why the schools aren't faring so well.
Well, I don't believe that I made that assertion, but I know that that is an assertion that has been made, and that is, of course, the major motivation behind the recently discussed consolidation legislation. Generally speaking, I believe, and we can get Minneapolis and St. Paul into this example, that the smaller the unit of the educational system, the more difficult it is to deal with declining enrollments. That is one of the reasons why the decline is not hurt the educational program in Minneapolis and St. Paul to the degree that it has in other parts of the state, including the suburbs. And we have school districts, for instance, in rural Minnesota, where we have 300 or 400 children, K through 12. and their capacity to react to declining enrollment is almost nil. You have to have a physics teacher. You have to have an English teacher in senior high school. And when you get smaller children or smaller numbers of children, you simply cannot cut staff in direct proportion to that decline. So generally speaking, the flexibility that larger units provide makes it easier for them to react to declining enrollments.
And we may want to return to a point of that question in a little bit. We have another caller on the line right now. We don't. I'll give out the numbers again, 291-1222 in the Twin Cities listening area. And for outstate listeners, 1-800-652-9700. Joe, there was a point in that question that we may want to cover a bit more. There's been some concern, I guess, among suburban residents in the Twin Cities that they think it might be wise to share school facilities with the neighboring suburb, and yet they don't exactly want to do that because they want to maintain local control. I'm not sure I understood the point of the caller's question, but is it possible that the suburban areas have established their boundaries in such a way that it's just not efficient for public education?
Well, I don't think there's any question but what that's the case. And, you know, school district boundaries were developed during the growth era, and they do not follow any logical pattern. We have school districts in the metropolitan area that are fast growth districts, and they will border on another district, which is a rapidly declining district. And so we have one school district consistently trying to build new buildings because it's a fast growth district, where 5 miles away we have a district declining with empty buildings or buildings under maximum utilization. And of course, that is one of the efficiencies that can be achieved through larger administrative units.
Now, was that something that should have occurred? In other words, 10 years ago, when public education was growing rapidly and the school districts saw the need to build more buildings, do we have a plan now on a statewide basis or a local basis whereby school district officials can look into the future, a bit farther ahead into the future, and see that they'll be able to tailor their planning more carefully?
Well, I guess I would tell you, Dan, that I'm not very pleased with our present capabilities as far as forecasting. We're working hard on developing that capacity within our Department of Education. But, you know, I generally would say that whether or not our existing system is good is an open question. There is a lot to be said for local control. And the smaller the unit, of course, the greater the degree of participation by local people. But there are inefficiencies, and the people, frankly, are going to have to decide whether they want to tolerate the inefficiencies of smaller districts as a trade-off against having increased local control.
Well, we have another caller on the line. Go ahead. Mr. Graba is listening to your question.
Yes. I'm an educator in Buffalo, Minnesota, and it strikes me that many parents that urge more back-to-basic programs are the same people that are urging a proliferation of extracurricular athletic programs in our school systems. And I'm wondering if there's anything in your mandate in the State Department of Education that can control the number of new extracurricular offerings in a school district, or if that is strictly left to local control.
Well, with the exception of the existing legislation and with the exception of court cases that require equal opportunities for girls, there is no mandate at the state level dealing with extracurricular activities. That is a local consideration, and there has been, obviously, a proliferation of extracurricular activities. I would lump that into the same general expectations that have been put onto the school systems in the last 15 years. The physical fitness issue is an issue, as well as the recreational opportunity for young people. And when we, in a scaling down period like we're facing in our educational system, I suspect that a lot of those extracurricular activities will come under severe scrutiny in those local boards.
But are you saying that's an issue that the local district people have to parcel out and the state doesn't have much to say about that?
That's right. That sort of decision has been left up to the local boards.
We have another caller on the line. Go ahead. Mr. Grava is listening to your question.
Thank you. There have been some suggestions that in order to deal with the education financing crisis, within the next few years, the legislature is going to have to redefine and restructure the foundation aid formula. I wonder if you have any idea what kind of a restructuring that might take, and if you just have any ideas about possibilities that the legislature might look in.
Well, let me say first of all that there is a lot of discussion about the existing system of financing schools. Minnesota launched itself on an equalization attempt in the 1971 legislative session. That was prior to some of the major court cases that have come down demanding that the amount of property wealth in a school district not severely affect the educational opportunity of the young people. Recently, there have been additional court cases. California, just in the last two or three weeks, got a court case down mandating that they revise their finance system. So Minnesota's finance system generally, I believe, is aimed in the right direction. Now, I very frankly tell people that there is nothing seriously wrong with our existing system that another $50 million a year wouldn't solve. The problem is not necessarily in the method of distributing revenue. It's simply in our problem exists in our inability to react to this declining enrollment. I think those same problems would exist with any formula. Now, there are a host of minor adjustments that could be made to our existing formula to deal with specific problems created by declining enrollment. I know, for instance, that this legislature is going to be looking at a staff aid. School districts with declining enrollment, as I mentioned earlier, have highly experienced staff. And there's been discussion about creating a factor in the foundation aid formula that would put more money into school districts that have highly experienced staff. The same thing is true with the education level of teachers. That's an additional factor that could be put into the formula, you know, our existing formula, to channel more money into school districts that have highly educated staff. I know also that this legislature will be looking at a sparsity factor in the formula. We do have a few school districts in the state that are getting smaller because of declining enrollments, but the areas, the geography is so large that they cannot be reasonably expected to consolidate. And so some sort of adjustment, I believe, will have to be made there. But generally speaking, I believe that we'll be dealing with alterations in the existing system rather than a totally new system of financing.
Well, I'm going to prevail on the callers who are waiting to ask questions of you, Mr. Graber, for a moment so that I can insert a question that may relate to what you just said. You talked about consolidation, and I am reminded that state legislator Gerald Anderson has proposed that the state school districts be consolidated into 92 countywide administrative districts. And I wonder if you could give a little background on that and describe whether or not, one, you think that's going to save any money, or two, whether or not that's going to help the quality of education any.
Well, it's extremely difficult to give accurate answers to those questions. I know that Senator Anderson has been working on this issue for a number of years. Senator Anderson has been the chairman of the Senate School Aid Subcommittee for the past 4 years and understands the finance system in our schools very well. There are some states that have countywide districts. For instance, Florida has a population, I believe, close to three times that of Minnesota and has 67 school districts. They have 67 counties, and the counties have school boards, and they operate the educational program. As I mentioned earlier, the larger the unit, the greater the degree of flexibility. If, for instance, we could combine Burnsville and Bloomington. Burnsville is a growing district, Bloomington a declining district. The building requirements from those two districts combined would be less than the building requirements for those two districts separate. And the same is true with respect to staff. The Burnsville system has been growing and consequently has been hiring new staff. The Bloomington district has been declining and consequently trimming staff. And so I believe the greatest savings is in the flexibility. But there is, of course, a cost, not in financial terms, but a cost in terms of local control. And so those are the two things that I believe this legislature is going to have to try to balance up.
All right. Now, I want to thank the caller who is on the line for waiting. And go ahead. Mr. Grabenow is listening to your question.
Do you think the school should be closed because of the weather?
Well, yes, I do think that we, as you know, the Commissioner of Education has recommended the four-day week. And that was done in view of the severity of the energy situation as we viewed it about 10 days ago. I am extremely concerned that we are not doing enough to ease this this energy crisis. I am extremely concerned that if the weather continues as it is today, that we're going to see widespread closings of schools and businesses and industries that is going to lead to unemployment and a lot of economic dislocation. We're hopeful that by adding a day to or an hour to each school day and going to 4 days, we could ease the energy situation and have the public sector doing a substantial amount of energy savings. Now, I know that that's disruptive. I know that many people disagree with that issue, but what we've seen happening on the East Coast, I believe, is a lot more severe than what we've suggested in Minnesota.
Just a quick question, Joe. Do you have any idea how much of a financial crunch this severe cold weather is putting on some selected districts around the Twin Cities area, for example?
No, we don't get very good information on a short-term basis from school districts as to what they're paying for energy. We do know, however, that school districts are doing an excellent job of conserving energy. The information that we gather on an annual basis indicates that they have made substantial conservation efforts since the 1973 crisis. Our department has been working closely with the plant managers, for instance, from various school districts. In fact, just last week we had some of our people out holding energy conservation seminars for the custodial staffs. And schools have been very, very good about employing conservation measures.
All right, and to our next caller, thank you for waiting, and Mr. Grabenow now is listening to your question.
My question is, who determines the content of the school program? That was my question. The comment is that since the turn of the century, schools have cut out the classics and installed sort of a trade schoolism. And as a result, it seems that students don't really have an appreciation of the past, and so that the country later is bound to repeat the mistakes of the past because of the lack of education.
Generally speaking, and I'm not sure I know what you mean by the content, if we're discussing the course offerings, that is to a large extent the decision of the local school board and local school administration. There are some basic requirements for schools that exist in the State Board of Education regulations and in the state law. And also, more recently, the federal government has enacted some requirements. But generally, the vast majority of program offerings that are in schools are there because of local decisions in the past. Now, if we're talking about what is taught specifically in a specific course, that generally is the decision of the actual teacher, although the administration has some authority to influence what the teacher actually teaches once the course is offered.
How do you react, though, to the comment that schools are more oriented towards the trade schoolism education, as the questioner put it?
Well, there has been the conscious attempt on the part of state and federal governments to get increased vocational training into our schools. There has, my personal opinion, that for years schools have been run by college graduates and taught by college graduates, and I was one of those, and consequently a disproportionate amount of the educational opportunities offered to children were aimed toward those who were college bound. And we've been attempting to get more of the vocational aspect into the system so that young people have a better understanding of what it's like, for instance, to be an auto mechanic or a carpenter or an electrician.
Good. Go ahead. Mr. Graba is listening to your question.
Good evening, Mr. Graba. Let me first preface my question by saying that I received my high school education in Ireland, so I did not go through the system here. But then let me say that I'm distressed with the casual way in which you dismiss the question about teaching of fundamentals here. I have heard similar sort of dismissals by other school officials where they make the statement to the effect that 95% of the high school seniors can pass functional literacy tests. To me, this is appalling. This is a statement of failure. And yet, I hear people making these statements in a manner that sort of indicates pride. I have encountered young men who are obviously intelligent and yet are totally unable to communicate because they can't write or spell. And it seems to me that this has got to be the primary, total issue that has to be dealt with in the high school systems. I respect the fact that there's a lot of flexibility in the high schools, but based on my observations from the outside and the fact that I've got young children who are going to be going to high schools, I certainly am. This is the biggest concern that I have in my mind, and I'd like you to address that in more totality, if you could, please.
Fine. I am sorry if I appeared to make light of that, because I don't feel that that's the case. Obviously I agree with you that it is a disgrace to have young people coming out of our school systems that are not capable of reading. But I would like to emphasize some things that have occurred in our school systems in the past 15 years, for instance. Minnesota today graduates a higher percentage of its young people than any state in the nation. Our dropout rate is either the lowest or the second lowest in the nation. We have a lot of young people in our schools today that simply were not in those schools 15 years ago. In addition to that, one must make the point that education is not a passive experience. It is not the kind of process that you can use in building automobiles. It requires a fair degree of participation on the part of the individual. Generally speaking, people in our society do not emphasize reading in the homes, do not emphasize reading in our society to the degree that they did years ago. Now, that's no excuse for the schools to reduce their emphasis on that issue, but it does make it more difficult to have young people capable of reading and reading well if they spend most of their evenings in front of the television set with their parents watching TV, whereas years ago the parents were perhaps reading. And so it's difficult for the schools to pick up on all of those attitudinal changes and supplement them to the degree to the point where we have everyone coming out with an adequate reading level. I don't think there's any question but what schools have got to get back to reemphasizing that. We've got to do a better job on the basics. I agree with that wholeheartedly. But there are some severe problems in achieving the 100% goal with respect to literacy.
All right. We have another questioner on the line. Go ahead. Mr. Graba is listening to your question.
Mr. Graba, you said that over the last 30 or 40 years, schools have taken on several services such as chemical dependency. And I think that probably also includes things like ecology and sex education, human relations, and so forth.
Right.
However, I understand that much research shows that personality, which causes these problems, develops in the first 6 or 7 years of life before a child even begins schooling. And therefore, My question is, if schools don't deal with these things like drug dependency prevention, sex education, human relations, and so forth, will those social problems continue to exist in the schools and cause student discipline problems in the classroom, and will the schools have to continue dealing with those problems?
Well, my general feeling is that, you know, that all of those achieve some good. I wouldn't disagree with the fact that the schools ought to be concerned about chemical dependency and a whole host of other issues that they've been expected to deal with. But I do believe that we have to expect that given a finite amount of time that a youngster is going to spend in school, that if we're going to we're going to dilute some of the other aspects of the educational program. We can't expect a child to spend several hours of his educational experience, perhaps several months, dealing with chemical dependency, and then expect that the young person will be equally good in some of the other areas that have had to been diluted in order to provide that time. And I believe that this is a problem. I would give to you, for instance, the whole area of physical fitness. Our schools are doing an excellent job in that area of physical fitness, not well enough to totally do away with our tendency to be a soft society because of our dependency on the automobile and other mechanical means. But that necessarily detracts from the attention of the young person towards his educational experience. It necessarily detracts from the amount of money available to provide those other educational experiences. And I believe that we've simply got to recognize that that's going to somehow dilute what we normally think of as the basic educational requirements.
Do you think it's worthwhile, Joe, for schools to be spending time on problems with chemical dependency, perhaps some other kinds of problems, when apparently, if you are to accept the questioner's argument, many of these problems establish themselves fairly early in life. Perhaps there isn't enough time spent on them in school to be worthwhile. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't know that we ought to look at the education about, for instance, chemical dependency as being a solution to chemical dependency. But I do think that chemical dependency is such a large aspect of our society that it's important to have people who are educated about the problem. So whether or not it actually solves the problem for a specific individual or prevents an individual from becoming chemically dependent, I think it's important that they understand the social ramifications and implications of that phenomena that exists in our society in a large proportion.
All right. We have another question for you, Joe. Go ahead. Mr. Graba is listening to your question.
Okay. I wonder if Mr. Graba would comment on the refusal of the part of the Golden Valley School District to consider merger with Minneapolis, and if this doesn't run contrary to the idea of integration, and then also whether or not the Minneapolis School District should be the school district that's dissolved, and that their merger then would be with the surrounding suburban school districts.
Well, maybe a little background to that question might be useful for some listeners.
Okay. The Golden Valley School Board, I believe, has come to the realization that with their declining enrollments, it's going to be very difficult for them to provide the same level of programming in the future that they have in the past. Consequently, they came to the Department of Education to ask for revenue to conduct a feasibility study for consolidation purposes. The commissioner and myself decided that we needed such a study, that consolidation studies had not been performed recently in the state, and we ought to, as a state department, participate in financing that sort of study. The Golden Valley District did not make the decision to not study the feasibility with Minneapolis. I made that decision, and I think that everyone ought to be aware of that. We actually considered six different alternatives. One was a combination of Golden Valley with Hopkins. Another was the combination of Golden Valley with St. Louis Park. Third one was a combination of Golden Valley with Robbinsdale. The fourth one was the combination, or leaving Golden Valley as it is. The fifth one was carving out a district for Golden Valley that is coterminous with the boundaries of the municipality, which means that the districts of Hopkins, Robbinsdale, and St. Louis Park would be reduced in size. And a sixth one was the combination of Golden Valley with Minneapolis. I thought that the political chances of the combination with Minneapolis passing a vote in the Golden Valley District were so slim that it was not a reasonable investment of tax dollars to consider it in this study. I also thought that that the political chances of getting a school district coterminous with the boundaries of Golden Valley were so slim that it did not merit study in our expenditure of tax dollars in this study. And consequently, I made the decision that the grant be limited to the feasibility of combining Golden Valley with either Park, Hopkins, or Robbinsdale.
And what about the idea of dissolving the Minneapolis school district and sending the students to the suburbs? What do you think about that? I'm not exactly sure what the reason for that would be, but it's an interesting proposition.
Well, obviously, Dan, it does have the potential to solve some of the desegregation problems of Minneapolis. It also, of course, has the potential to create, I think, tremendous upheaval in the people of the suburbs. And that, when we deal with the realities of how to spend money, tax money, efficiently, I was simply convinced that in the $50,000 study that we were going to fund, that there wasn't going to be enough money to adequately study that problem.
Good. We have another questioner on the line. Go ahead. Mr. Graba is listening to your question.
Yes. I heard you talking about the course offerings and the problem of reading and mathematics and things like that. And you continually talk about dollars and cents and money and strictly numbers. Is there any group that watches out for the good, or that like a consumer advocate or a student advocate that takes into account the impact that the fact that the money goes here or goes there, what a impact that will have on the course offerings? Because where the money is, this is where the teaching tends to go too, doesn't it?
That's definite. Yes, that's where the where the activity focuses. I would tell you that, you know, our system operates under the assumption that the parents and the voters in local districts are the advocacy group for the young people. And I don't want to seem excessively harsh, but I think it's fairly accurate to say that the public has not been paying enough attention to what's going on in local units of government. I think that same sort of accusation can be made with respect to state government and with respect to federal government. Local school boards are an attempt to bring the decisions to the local level. Otherwise, this state might as well run the whole educational program from the state level. But there's no way to make participatory democracy work if the people don't participate. And in the decisions that are being made in school districts as to where to allocate the dollars, if the parents do not express their opinions, then of course those that do express their opinions are going to get the money channeled in the direction that they want it channeled. I would tell you very frankly that that has happened in areas in most school districts that I personally would disagree with. But then that is the way the system operates, and only the people can change it.
All right. We have time for one more call. Go ahead. Mr. Graba is listening to your question.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Graba, with respect to an earlier caller who stressed classics over what he calls trade schoolism, can I make a comment? I have a boy in the Hastings system. The Hastings system is an excellent system. But in the eighth grade, he was in ninth now, but in the eighth grade last year, he was required to take home economics. Now, let me tell you in 30 seconds what kind of boy this is. This is a boy who has no interest in such matters. He's a boy. If it had been food preparation, I could see something in it. But why is a boy asked to do home economics as a required subject?
I can't answer your question, sir, because I don't understand the reasoning behind that requirement. There is no state regulation that anyone take home economics. There's no federal regulation. If your son was required to take home economics in the Hastings system, that was either a conscious decision on the part of the school board, or it was a scheduling problem that the school district had to react to. And I guess I'm inclined to question the desirability of requiring boys to take home economics, although I certainly support the concept that if they want to, they ought to be able to.
Well, unfortunately, we will be unable to take any further questions from Mr. Graba, because I have one question that I think ought to be covered, and then I want to get to a bit of weather information. Joe, finally, we've been talking mostly about suburban and city school district problems, but there is another problem that I'd like you to address briefly, and that is the situation faced by some rural school districts where the value of the agricultural land in much of the rural districts has become so valuable, in fact, that the tax on that land represents more money raised than the state aid to that rural school district. And so as a result, the local district, the rural district, is not eligible for state aid. In other words, they're using only the money they raised from the local tax on that land. Am I accurate in that assessment? And if I'm accurate, is that a real problem for some of those rural districts?
Well, yes, it is. It's a definite problem and a growing problem with respect to our finance system. And it's a serious concern at the state level as well as at the local level. The combination of escalating land values and declining enrollments is bringing more and more of the school districts out of our formula. I believe that this current school year we have about 5 districts in the state where the 29 mills actually raises more than $960 per pupil unit in that school district. Now, one of the things that from an equity standpoint on taxes, one must remember that in addition to the $900 million a year that the state puts out to the schools and school aid expenditures, we have a whole host of indirect aids. The ag differential is a substantial expenditure to ease that problem. And the same is true with the homestead credit, the circuit breaker, and the senior citizens tax freeze on homestead property. So one must consider the total tax picture in addition to the school aid system, Dan.
Good. Thank you, Joe Graba, Deputy Commissioner of Education from the Minnesota Department of Education. And I also owe thanks to 2 legislative analysts from the State House of Representatives research staff for helping me prepare this program. They are Sarah Peterson and Barbara Diamond. Technical director for this program was Lynn Cruz, and she was aided by Neil St. Anthony. And, of course, I want to thank all the listeners for, again, posing excellent questions to our guests this Saturday morning.